Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Blair Tindall. Blair is a Chapel Hill native. She's the author of a Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. So, Blair, I want to talk about classical music. Blair Tindall grew up in Chapel Hill, then attended, was accepted in the North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, went on to a classical music career in New York and traveling throughout the country as an oboist, maybe the hardest instrument in the whole orchestra to play. Left her music career behind, or at least partially behind, to become a writer. Went to journalism school and has written this book, Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music, which has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of favorable attention, for lots of reasons. And it's been highly criticized on some quarters. But Blair's come from California to visit family in Chapel Hill, gotten off the plane to talk to us. Thanks, Blair Tindall.
Thanks for having me, DG. It's a pleasure.
What'd you think about driving into Chapel Hill? Is good memories, bad memories, mixed set of memories? How do you feel? Like, is Chapel Hill your home?
Chapel Hill is my home. And when my father passed away last year, I spent 5 months here. I had not spent any length of time here for decades. And it was just a pleasure. And I felt as if I'd parachuted back into the old, same wonderful, warm group of friends.
Well, a lot of us love your daddy, George Tindall, who's, one of the world's country's greatest historians, with many students who worship him, and I think a son and a daughter who worship him as well.
We certainly do.
And a lot of people in Chapel Hill miss him. So you keep on coming back to visit?
I do. My mother's here. She's 86, and she's in the best of health and the best of spirits.
That's great. When you were back in Chapel Hill for an extended period of time, what about it did you notice? I mean, what parts of it did you notice and say, hey, this isn't the same Chapel Hill? Did you miss anything?
The sprawl of Chapel Hill is enormous now. It's almost as if the Triangle area is becoming one large metropolitan area. And I do miss the first block of Franklin Street, that main block. It's just not the same as it was, but it seems like all of that has moved into this Restaurant Row in Carrboro that's got the same sort of flavor and panache that
Franklin
Street
had. So if
you want
to visit Chapel Hill of the 60s and 70s and 80s, go to Carrboro. Is that what you... I mean,
well, maybe not of the 60s. It might be missing a few facets of that. But Chapel Hill is still very much the way it was, and there's so many old families and old traditions that have remained.
Well, tell us about. This is leading up to the question of why did you write the book? But will you give us a little background about your career, about your musical career, beginning with your piano and then your oboe in Chapel Hill, and how that got started?
Well, my parents got me started on the piano before I could read words. I could read music before I could read words, and I studied with several piano teachers here. And the time came in the sixth grade at Estes Elementary School, where they put us in a band room and gave us a little test to see how talented you were. And it consisted of questions like, is this note louder or softer, or higher or lower? And I passed, apparently, and was given a choice of instruments, and that made me very excited. I wanted to play the flute or the trumpet or something sort of high and brilliant and soloistic. And we went through the class in alphabetical order, and I was second from the last. So Rye Young and I got oboes. We did have
the oboes were the only ones left?
Oboes
well, there
and
two
bassoons.
Oboes? Were there two oboes?
There were
in
three, actually.
Three?
Someone else at the end of the alphabet got the third oboe. But that's how I started this career as an oboist. And
That was all that was left.
That was my choice, oboe or bassoon. Bassoon wouldn't work very well on the bicycle, so I chose the oboe. And went off to the North Carolina School of the Arts for high school for 3 years. And then
now what back up? How did you get from Estes Elementary music class, little band, I guess, or little orchestra, to North Carolina School of the Arts?
Well, I graduated to the Guy B. Phillips band, and oboes were fairly scarce, and I was fairly good at it. So I caught the attention of quite a few educators who were always trying to recruit kids for things like the Brevard Music Center, Eastern Music Festival, North Carolina School of the Arts.
So Brevard maybe was the bridge to...
Possibly, because that's where I got out of well, not that I needed to get out of Chapel Hill, but I sort of broadened my network of musicians and found out what else was out there. And that continued at the School of the Arts. And when I graduated there at the age of 18...
Your parents are happy that you're in the music environment because they love music. But also your father, probably one of the most better liberally educated, well-educated people in the world. Did he have mixed feelings about your getting off on the conservatory route?
Well, I think so, because they had hoped I would follow in my brother's footsteps and go to high school at the Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire. And really, a career in music was a fairly new thing in the 60s, which is a lot of the topic of my book. It has not in America been something that you could do for a living for much longer than my lifetime. And my father, I think, saw it as a great new opportunity, and he loved music. You know, he's a big fan of the Ring Cycle. We sat through it twice at the Metropolitan Opera, the whole 24 hours of it. And I think they saw it as something a little bit untested, and I think they were fearful of the academic shortcomings of conservatories, and I must say they were right. But I did end up going to New York and having quite a wonderful career at a time really during the halcyon days of classical music in America, which were in the 80s and early 90s. I was very lucky to play with the New York Philharmonic and the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. I did a solo debut at Carnegie Hall. I did wild things like play on the soundtrack of Spike Lee films, Malcolm X. I'm what you hear when Malcolm X lies dying. That's me all by myself. I played with Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones at the Blue Note Jazz Club. So it led me in directions.
Well, one of the things that you missed that you cover in your book, which was most positive to me, was that you got to be a part of these long-running Broadway musicals that many of us would have to pay $300 or $400, I guess, now to see. But Les Mis and... Miss Saigon, you're there in the pits now. I mean,
yes.
You don't brag about that. Or do you brag about that?
Broadway is a wonderful job for musicians. It pays quite well, and they have a very liberal policy so that you can take off and do other work so that you are not playing that every night. It seems very glamorous, but think about it. A long-running show, Miss Saigon, I played for 6 years, 8 times a week. That's over 400 times a year. Thousands of times I have played Miss Saigon.
You can do it. Yeah, I think you told us that you could do it and you could read the New York Times. You could work crossword puzzles.
Well, this is interesting. Now that I'm a writer, too, I have these wonderful opportunities to meet people I would never meet otherwise. I interviewed Oliver Sacks, the neuroscientist, last week. It's going to run in the LA Times next week, I believe. And I told him that I often memorized a Broadway show within 2 months and never used the music again and read while I was playing, which is probably not something I should be bragging about.
Right. Go ahead.
But it is, you know, it really is so repetitive. And after you've played something thousands, and really Les Mis, I have played thousands of times.
So you could do it in your sleep, really. I mean, or you could at that point.
Felt like it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to say I was playing in my sleep because, you know, there are people out there paying now $300 and $400. Well, you want to give your best. But it was a strange little quirk of neuroscience. And I noticed about, you know, two or three people in every pit I played in seemed to be able to do this. There was a guy who had a thing for maps and studied maps during the entire show. He never used the music. He'd just pick up his trumpet for a few minutes, play, and he was back to the maps. But Sachs said that he had noticed, we were talking about things like musical hallucinations, which is when there's music playing in your head that you can't turn off, which is horrible for musicians because you have to be playing something else that might not have anything to do with what you're hearing. And he said this might be somewhat related to that. And he admitted that he even sometimes jots down notes with his right hand while he's playing piano harmonies with his left hand. He's an amateur pianist. So I guess it's not that unusual a trait after all. But it is Broadway shows, you know, every once in a while I'll see a little something on television about the backstage life of Broadway. And I look at it now, years later, and it really is exciting and glamorous. And these shows take these incredibly high-tech shows take place in theaters that were built in the 20s and 30s and just have no backstage area. And wigs and
all crowded, everything.
Props, yeah. And musicians are all crammed in. And it really is very, you know, it's sort of an exciting slice of life that I wouldn't have missed for the world.
Well, this is the way I think of it, is my golly, she's up there with all of these actors and actresses. And in your book, you describe the scene. I want you to correct me if I've misremembered this, but it is, first of all, you point out, you're not on stage. You're in the pit. And so the actors get the attention, as properly they should, but you're playing this beautiful music, but nobody sees you. So you're not the star. So you're talking about maybe leaving the walking out after the performance, and maybe some kids say, "Oh, hey, there's a showgirl," and the other one says, "Oh, no, they're just nobody," or something like that. So that you're undercover almost, and not like you are on stage when you're playing with the Philharmonic, where people can see you and watch you and see that you look great and everything.
This is true. I remember seeing a rerun of Sid Caesar's Show of Shows, and there was a funny little skit about a drummer who was communicating with an audience member in the front row. And in the Broadway theaters of the 50s, they were almost at the same level, the front row and the musician. The pit floor has dropped so that you're way down in the basement now, and often the top of the pit is covered by bits of stage. Sometimes it's completely covered by a scrim, which was the case in Chorus Line. And sometimes, believe it or not, the musicians are even upstairs in several different rooms and communicate via sound monitors and video cameras. And this became such a concern for the musicians' union that in Cats, where this was the case, they insisted, it's now part of the Broadway contract, that if the orchestra can't be seen, there has to be a photograph of the orchestra posted in the lobby so that the audience knows there's actually a live orchestra. I feel like we've gotten this far away from it sounding live because it's piped through these sometimes not great sound systems. Why are we having a live orchestra?
Yeah, well, more and more down here in non-union shops, it's rare that you see the music is almost always piped in via recording. And,
right.
And we've lost that, whatever, the spontaneity and the fun of having the live music as a part of a live performance is sort of disappearing, I guess.
And also, you don't have as much control as you do, say, in a symphony orchestra concert. You're playing and somebody else is turning you up or turning you down. And when I've gone out and heard my substitute play, the time you have to actually, you know, not play the show in order to see the show. I was amazed at what could be heard and what couldn't. I was kind of horrified, actually. It made me realize I needed to be a little more careful.
One part you talked about, this was a funny part of the book, was in the middle of a performance, you could hear a toilet flush. And it was one of the actors, one of the musicians, somebody had forgotten to turn the mic off.
Sound guy forgot to turn the mic off. You know, there are endless stories of you hearing all sorts of bodily functions you'd rather not, booming through the theater because somebody forgot to turn off a mic.
All right, well, I'm talking to Blair Tindall. Blair is a Chapel Hill native, the author of a book called Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Blair Tindall. Blair grew up in Chapel Hill. She's the daughter of the late George Tindall, great historian and professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of the U.S. history book that many of us had in college. And Blair, welcome back to Chapel Hill.
Thank you.
All right, now you've written this great book, Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. And there's a lot of sex and a lot of drugs and a lot about the classical music scene. The critics of your book, a lot of people line up and say, forget about the sex and the drugs. This is the best description of what's going on or what has gone on in the last 20 years or what's happened to the classical music scene in the world. But nevertheless, you got sex and drugs. And what does sex and drugs have to do with this story?
Book sales? No, I'm just kidding. I mean, the original subtitle was something a lot more subdued called Life in the Withering World of Classical Music. But my agent, my agent and I looked at that and we thought, you know, nobody's going to buy this book. We've got it. If we want people to read it, we're going to have to go all the way. And frankly, it's not, you know, especially given the time, post-sexual revolution, pre-AIDS, it really isn't that shocking. I mean, it's sort of a slice of life
this
from that period.
This growing up time was the time after we, sex and drugs sort of got unleashed. That is in kind of an I wish I'd knew more about this, an explosion. But before, the disease worry and then sort of a reformation put a little bit of a quietus there were, in both sex and drugs, I guess.
Well, especially in the music world, nobody saw the AIDS explosion more close up than people in the arts. Mm. I mean, we saw our friends developing these horrible skin lesions. Nobody knew what it was. The first person I knew to die of AIDS died in 1982. No one knew what it was. No one knew how it was contracted. And people were dropping around us like flies. I had a list. I knew 100 men who died of AIDS personally. And that was when I was in my mid-20s. I mean, it really sort of took the edge off the profundity of death.
I remember you said I kept the list until it got to be 100, then I threw it away.
Then I threw it away. It was just, and there's still people periodically who will go, even now with all the drugs.
So among, now this, honestly, the idea of gay men, and I guess women, but primarily you think of gay men, I guess because men dominated the classical music world. We knew that there were gay men and gay sex in the classical music world, and in an arts world altogether.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that was a shock to anybody. I mean, Leonard Bernstein was quite open about it, even though he was married for since the 60s, I think. So that wasn't a shock. But it was just the health problems. And also, people were in the sexual revolution swinging, shall we say, and going every which way. So they're
trying
everything. And also the drugs part of it. Fortunately, I never got interested in drugs myself, but they were ruining lives all around me, and classical musicians were not immune from this. I mean, there, a lot of what I'm trying to express in my book is that classical musicians are just like everyone else. They are people who are very well-schooled in what they do. They're very disciplined. They've often worked from the time they're small children to perfect their art. But there are so few outlets for them to make a living doing this, and they are just like other people and fall prey to depression and substance abuse and all of these other things that may not seem evident when you go, say, to the North Carolina Symphony and see them in their tuxedos and long gowns in that beautiful new concert hall.
Right,
but
right.
They're just people who are, you know, have families and are struggling to pay the mortgage just like everybody else. And make, in many cases, shockingly little. And while I was here taking care of my mother's things after my father passed away, I stayed with a friend in Raleigh who is a freelance musician who plays quite often with the symphony. And she would get on a bus, you know, and really just troop off to the ends of the state to play for school children, because that's part of the mission, which is a wonderful mission of the North Carolina Symphony. But boy, they work hard for very little money.
Well, how do I approach this? One of the poignant parts of your book, and I don't want to say you woke up, but you at some point you in the book you reassessed your career and said, "Oh my gosh, I've got all these for a young person, and then I've had all these great positions. You know, I've gotten, but." The people who've gotten me there are all people that I've been involved with sexually, you know. And you kind of said, what I've got, and this, I'm putting words into your mouth, but this was the way it came out in the book. Oh, my golly, you know, I'm just trading sex for positions in the orchestra. But it wasn't that way at all, was it? I mean, this is coincidental.
Well, I did make a tongue-in-cheek statement in the book that was meant to be humorous, which was, and I do hope my mother doesn't hear this, I got all my jobs in bed. That was supposed to be a joke, and everybody picked it up and thought I was taking it literally.
No, but I think I took it in the right way that this was what you're. Oh my gosh, you know, I got all my great. But you're thinking this not because there was a trade. It was, but coincidentally, you were sleeping with the guys who were able to get make it helpful. And then when the relationship broke off, you all of a sudden noticed, hey, I didn't get invited back when I wasn't.
It's, I mean, office was romance. It's
right. No, I'm kidding.
What you're talking about is all the reasons they tell you not to get involved with somebody you work with in an office. Our office is, you know, on a tour bus on backstage, and we tend to just be around other musicians because the schedule is very odd. You're often out of town. You're traveling with a group of 80 people, say, if you're traveling with the New York Philharmonic. It's not like you have opportunities to expand your social circle much outside of music. If you try to start going out on dates Saturday night, you're not going to get much work because that's when
concerts happen. So you're restricted in the universe of eligible people with whom,
yes,
to become friends or lovers or whatever is. I would imagine, hey, these people are traveling all over the world. They get to meet all of these people, and you know they're. But you're the way you say we're trapped on this. In the concert hall, in the practice hall, on the bus,
well,
with a
I have
limited
to say
universe.
That the company is often delightful. I mean, the company of musicians is often just wonderful, but it is the same group of people, mm-hmm, you know, and by the time I left New York, I had known these people for a quarter of a century. So I knew all of them very well, shall we say. We all knew each other very well. But my purpose in writing this book and the memoir aspect of it was to make a list of every issue I could think of facing the arts in America during the late 20th century. And I did that and went up to the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire, an artist's colony, and I had papers stuck all over the four walls of my cabin and tried to find a vignette from my own life or the lives of these other people I lived with in this musician's tenement that would illustrate these things. And so I found these romances. I've chose just a few romances, and I did have romances with people I wasn't, you know, who didn't directly affect my career, but I was trying to keep the number of romances a little down. It was a time and place when, you know, people were a lot friskier than they are now. So I was trying to depict how, you know, just your social life can either affect you positively in a professional way, or it can make everything come crashing down irreparably.
Well, is the point then simply, as you say, office romance, that it's that looking back on it, for you and for people, other people who are in the business of trying to further their career in the music world, don't get involved with people who are your supervisors, or don't get involved with your boss romantically.
Probably a good idea, unless it's very serious and leading to marriage. But then there were marriages constantly breaking up, too, and, you know, people on a tour bus of 26 musicians, several of whom had been married to each other and were no longer.
And were no longer married.
I think it's pretty much, it's sort of like living in a small town, or it's like living in a small town.
Well, except, yeah, but a small town has more than 50 or 70 people and outlets. Am I right about this? Maybe broader outlets for experience and connections with.
It's true. I mean, you can find ways of broadening your horizons, but when you are on the road with people or seeing them in the pit every night, it you do just tend to go the easy route and socialize with the people you're working with directly.
I guess that's right. Well, it opened my thoughts. I guess it changed my mind too much about the romance, the excitement of being a part of a really high-charged arts group traveling around from place to place. Instead of looking at this as, oh, this is wonderful, I'm saying, oh, no, this is not for me.
Well, let me tell you, though, when you're in a group, say a chamber orchestra of 26 people, and I'm thinking of something like the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. I was never a member, but I was fortunate to substitute with them quite a bit in the 80s. These are people who really love music. They put this group together themselves. There's no conductor. And they all know each other really well. It really is like a family. Several of them have been married to each other. And it is the music takes on this power that's quite incredible, because people also have this social and very personal connection. And, I mean, they've known each other now and been playing together for 35 years.
So this is like a family unit. Rather than kind of the thrown together musical performances that you might see other places with very fine performers, but who haven't gotten to know each other, don't know how, and don't have the passion for performing together. They want to play their piece and move on to the next one.
It could be, although I've found there's this, there's quite a connection that comes through playing with music, even if you've never met the people before, as often happens on pickup gigs. On, you know, you get called to do a movie score. There are people that you've never played with, and you communicate in a way that really does elude words, and it's a fantastic thing. I mean, I wish everybody could participate in that, and that's one of the big points of my book, is that in America, we have lost this sort of amateur, avocational way of making music. There are amateurs out there who are very good, but people tend to think, with the rise of music as a career possibility in the late 20th century, that if you're not Heifetz, you just shouldn't do it at all. And that's such a shame. I mean, I look back at my parents and our you know, sort of rinky-dink upright piano, and they were constantly just playing. I mean, they never thought of being professional musicians, but they'd sit down at the piano and play and sing, and it was just a great part
of growing
up.
So you'd argue for more classical music gigs, that is, people coming from different directions, getting together, and like these country musicians do at the storefronts on Friday nights, and just come together and see what happens.
Or here, I may be way out of date, but there was something called the Village Band here many years ago. I hope it's still going. And, you know, there was a physicist down the street from us who played trumpet in it, and all manner of people just got together and played for the pleasure of it without it having to be a professional gig.
Good for listeners, or just good for those players playing together and having a good time together?
Both.
All right. Talking to Blair Tindall, talking about her book, Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Blair Tindall. Blair Tindall is a Chapel Hill native, grew up here, and then went on to a wonderful career in music, in classical music, beginning at the North Carolina School of the Arts, and winding up when she was playing, I guess, we were talking on the break about statistics, then I want to move to another part of your book. What?
Well, people ask me why I wrote this book. And it seems to appeal to
I should ask you that question.
DG.
I don't know. That's the basic question. I missed it. Thanks.
It's a long story, but to make a long story short, I was amazed. A single statistic is what made me write this book. A single fact. There was no full-time orchestra in the United States until 1964.
No.
The New York Philharmonic went full-time in 1964.
So everybody else, until 1964, and this is about the time you were born.
But somewhere around there.
Long before you were born, but in the 60s. And it was when I was a grown man. I mean, this is important to me because this is during my adulthood, that was the first time that you could look to have a full-time career in music anywhere. Is that right? I mean, in an orchestra.
You could cobble it together in New York, that's for sure, between the New York Philharmonic,
with
the NBC Symphony.
Yes.
I mean, possibly the NBC Symphony back in the 30s and 40s. But here is the basic startling thing about what I have to say about classical music in America. It's not dying. It's never been healthier. This is the healthiest it's ever been. And what people were not willing to look at, or maybe the information wasn't out there, and I felt as if I had collected this eureka moment's worth of information, was that it really was not until that seminal moment when the New York Philharmonic went full-time that people started to think, oh, this is something we can do as well as the Russians can do it. It was sort of a Cold War.
That's in the U.S., though. In Europe, you could have had a career as a full-time musician for many. I mean, there were sponsorships and the kings and the governments.
Although their government sponsorship in Europe is way down.
It's declining now, but
in a big way.
Historically,
their music system grew out of the court system that was, you know, there were patrons of music, and then the government sort of took over. But now that's sort of tapering off. But here we have this wonderful system of nonprofit organizations that are not, they don't have to pay taxes, and people can contribute to them and not have to pay taxes. And that's sort of our government's support of the arts.
So if somebody read your book and saw the struggles that you had to go through and some of the torture that classical musical performers have to go through in order to survive, they'd get the wrong message if they thought you were being discouraged about the music scene. You really want to say, be an optimist about this. Music's in good shape.
Music's in great shape, but I don't think it's something to blithely follow as a career path without really investigating what's involved and what your chances are when you get out of school.
Like a kid on a pro basketball
it
career.
It is so similar to the sports track. And if you go to a music conservatory, you will likely get a wonderful musical education, but you'll have little exposure to history, sciences, mathematics, writing
skills. But if you don't go to a music conservatory, you're not going to get the skills that will that will set you apart
well,
as a performer.
Well, it didn't seem to hurt Yo-Yo Ma.
So you'd recommend that a aspiring musician, as you would an aspiring professional athlete, go to get a liberal arts education in the context with good training, and then hold off on the real conservatory education and professional development until that liberal education's behind you? I mean, is that where you're going with this, or what?
No, I mean, you can... Yo-Yo Ma, for example, started out at Juilliard, and he decided to transfer to Harvard. He has a bachelor's degree from Harvard. That's it. I mean, he didn't go to music conservatory. There are other notable examples, like Joshua Bell, a fabulous violinist. He went to Indiana University, which has a wonderful conservatory within the university. So there are places like that. Eastman... is it in Rochester? Oberlin College is another one. Or someplace like Juilliard, if you're really on the ball, has a cooperative program with Columbia University so that you can, if you're really focused, take
and
courses
that's if
up
you
there.
Had, you'd like to have done that, since you had to do your liberal arts education in journalism after
Well,
your...
I would have, because when the time came that I wanted to do something else, I couldn't, because I could barely add and subtract. I just didn't...
Remedial math instruction
I
to
had
get
to go
you in shape.
In my mid-30s back to Columbia University and start with 2+2.
Well, I want to talk... I guess the most poignant moment in your book for me, and I'm sure that it'll be different for every reader, but this was where you'd worked your whole career to get the audition for an oboe seat in the New York Philharmonic. And you're well prepared in the sense that you'd substituted in the Philharmonic, you've been well received, had good notes, been a struggle, but you were an accomplished oboist with good reviews, struggling only, like all oboists do, with those... Well,
pesky
I can't say
reeds.
The word, the pesky, yeah, I would say, you know, you just can't say the word. But the reeds that apparently one of the tricks of being a good oboist is being able to, is it cut reeds or to whatever you do, you got to make your own reeds. You seem at the moments in your career, your reeds let you down, and they let you down in this audition.
And then the
whole world collapsed. I mean, I just cried when I read this.
This
just,
is the great tragedy for people who play reed instruments, especially double reed instruments. It is possible to buy decent reeds, but somebody who's playing on a high professional level week in and week out really has to make their own reeds. And it's a species of cane called Arundo donax. It grows in a couple of places. It grows in California, and it's actually an invasive weed. And it grows in the south of France. And you buy it by the pound or by the kilo. And it comes, you know, just like those bamboo wind chime tubes. And you measure it and cut it and whittle it. And I am just terrible at this. I'm a good musician.
So you're
I can't
a good oboist,
reeds.
But you can't make reeds. And it's a fatal... But you couldn't... Can you hire a reed maker to follow you around and do
this takes, for you? It is so time-consuming. I would sometimes make reeds 60 hours a week. And I am so relieved not to be doing that anymore. I do have a source for reeds, but I'm not playing constantly
I've got to take a break. I'd like to talk to you about this for hours, but we got to stop, take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about another poignant moment in your book. I'm talking to Blair Tindall, author of Mozart in the Jungle. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Blair Tindall, the author of Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. You're a famous Chapel Hillian. I mean...
or an infamous Chapel Hillian.
You and Alexander Julian are our celebrities.
How about James Taylor?
Oh, yeah. Well, in the music world, he's second to you.
Oh, please.
Listen, your book, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music, lots to read about. As the careful reviewers of your book point out, it's much more than the sex, drugs. It is a look into the classical music scene that has both positive and negative aspects, and some have called it the best overall view of classical music that's been written. But it's also a memoir. And a lot of sexual adventures that got, you know, old men excited as we read about it. But the thing that I kept thinking, you know, this young woman's had lots of boyfriends and lots of relationships. Where is the love of her life? And so there's this really poignant description of your affair and friendship with Sam, whose profession, I guess, was an accompanist to...
Yes, I think...
Tell me about that.
Well, people who listen to classical music around here will hear Samuel Sanders all the time on recordings on the radio. He played with the most famous musicians, Itzhak Perlman and such. He was Itzhak's regular accompanist. And he sort of made accompanying a respectable profession and brought up the salaries a little bit, although he still ended up, I feel, getting abused quite a bit. He was a remarkable man. He was born... with a congenital heart defect in the 30s that could be fixed immediately today, but at the time he was a blue baby, it couldn't be fixed. He was given 9 years to live and 5 open heart surgeries, including 2 heart transplants. Later, he lived to the age of 62.
He's the love of your life, right? I mean, if you had to pick out the one person, this was the person that you were most deeply emotionally involved with.
Well, I would say. You know, on a friendship basis, he was the love of my life. And he was sort of the hero of my life, too, because he showed me so many ways of living and rising above an impossible situation.
Well, other than your father, he's the man you miss the most.
I miss him all the time. He's been gone now 8 years. He died after his second heart transplant. But he was just a remarkable human being who, you know, was... after he'd been sliced open and his heart replaced, was up and about and trying to get at a piano keyboard. And he would practice through the night. He'd practice to sunrise. He was just obsessed with music.
Well, I'll just say, I won't press you any more on that, but just to say that your description of your relationship with him is poignant and really, beautiful experience. Now, we haven't got any more time, but you're in the news again now with your buddy. Is Bill Nye the Science Guy your husband? I mean, what is the?
Okay.
Will you tell us about this? And is all this going on just so you can write another book about?
No, I'm not. I don't wish Bill any ill will. I really wish I knew what had happened. And when you were talking about Sam, I was thinking, I wasn't sure if you'd noticed that in the news or not, but. I did have a little romp through the tabloids.
Right, yeah, tell us about this.
And Bill really was, in many ways, the love of my life.
Oh, he was, okay. Now, they're just, I mean, not people, we don't know. There was a public marriage.
I'll tell you what happened, because I can
gotta
now
do it
talk
quick,
about
it. Quick.
Okay, we were engaged, and we were given the opportunity by...
Bill Nye, the science guy, public television guy, just for those...
Right, Emmy-winning public television guy, by Pastor Rick Warren, who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life, to be married on the spot in front of 400 strangers. And we did, and it was broadcast. It was run in 300 newspapers. We bought a $1 million house together. And then the marriage license was returned invalid and unrecorded because in the state of California, you have to buy it before the ceremony. And Rick had instructed us to go off and buy it after the ceremony and send it to him. And anyway, all the correct dates were entered, which invalidated it. So we were never married.
So you're never married.
And then the whole thing fell apart, and I wish I knew why. I couldn't even begin to hasten to guess, and I'm very sad about it. But I wish Bill nothing... but the best. I had a bit of a rough year after that.
So this is a rough time, but I was wrong. It's not Sam, it's Bill Nye. And you're in the middle of recovering from this.
Well, the thing with Bill fell apart. The real estate thing was quite a problem. I was then hit by a car on my bike. My dad died, and I spent so 5 months straightening things out. But everything's on the upswing now. Everything's just fine.
Well, can you? I mean, you've now shown that you're an accomplished memoirist. I mean, is this the grist for more?
It is. At the end of this very tragic year in my life, I had not slept more than an hour a night in a year, so I was not thinking straight. And I ended up taking myself, as you can in California now, to a rehab for insomnia. You can take yourself to a rehab for perfectionism if you want. So I went to this wonderful holistic place, and they got me all straightened out. But it was quite a story. And I mean, there were alcoholics and drug addicts there as well, and several other people who were not. And there's I'm writing a Rehab Nation Corruption in
Well, I can't wait. Will you come back and talk to us about it?
And I'm also working on a television show that would be a travel show, much like Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations, but using ethnic music and dance.
Well, Blair Tindall, we got much more to talk about. Thanks for coming back to Chapel Hill to visit with us and telling us about your book and your career. My guest has been Blair Tindall, author of Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music.
Thanks, DG.
Thank you, Blair. Thanks to all y'all for listening. Be back same time tomorrow.